Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. Here are today's business headlines. HHLA expects revenue, earnings to rise this year. UniCredit, UBS, Nomura lose attempt to block EU fines. Dollar Tree to sell Family Dollar business for $1 billion. Dollar Tree loss widens, confirms sale of Family Dollar business. Retailers bulk up inventories to blunt tariff impact. Farmers, dockhands, and ship owners fight against U.S. fees on Chinese ships. For importers, rushing to beat tariffs, it's life on the edge. French shipping magnate pledges to help Trump revive U.S. shipping. Trump administration readies order to bolster U.S. shipbuilders, punish China. Activist Elliot sues Phillips 66 and board in another push for seat changes. The first article I'll read today is Germany's HHLA expects revenue earnings to rise this year. The company was able to post increases in revenue and earnings in 2024. Mainly thanks to the expansion of its European network, by Dominic Chopping. German transport and logistics provider Hamburger Hafen and Logistik expects to report revenue and earnings growth this year on an increase in container transport and demand for port services. The Hamburg terminal operator, known as HHLA, specializes in seaport terminal and port services, as well as container and transport logistics. It said it spent 2024 focusing on strengthening its European network, particularly by increasing the number of rail connections, in addition to further modernizing and automating its container terminals in Hamburg. In uncertain times, it's crucial to strategically remain on track, Chief Executive Angela Titzrath said. Based on the growth of revenue and earnings, we are now able to look forward with optimism to 2025. Despite global challenges such as weakness in the German economy, conflict in the Middle East, and the war in Ukraine, HHLA said it was able to post increases in revenue and earnings in 2024, mainly thanks to the expansion of its European network. Transport volumes rose significantly at its intermodal business, which offers transport services via rail, truck, and ship, while it also benefited from an increase in container storage charges at Hamburg terminals. That was thanks to port congestion last year, as shipping diversions caused attacks on vessels in the Red Sea and port strikes in the U.S. ramped up pressure on ports and meant containers were held in port for longer, leading to increased storage fees. Container handling at the company's seaport terminal edged higher, as lower volumes in routes to and from the Far East and Middle East were offset by strong growth for the North and South America shipping regions. Cargo volumes also increased for other European seaports, particularly Belgium and Greece, which was due to temporary route adjustments caused by the Red Sea disruption. Overall, the group reported a 23% rise in earnings before interest and tax to 134.3 million euros in 2024 on year, as revenue rose 10% to 1.6 billion euros. The company had guided for EBIT of between 125 million and 145 million euros. For 2025, it expects strong revenue growth and EBIT of between 195 million and 235 million euros, between 180 million and 220 million euros of that is expected to come from its port logistics unit that is made up of the container, intermodal, and logistics businesses. Its real estate unit, which develops, designs, and lets buildings such as warehouses and commercial sites in Hamburg, is expected to see a strong drop in earnings this year from the 16.1 million euros it reported in 2024. The company proposed a full-year dividend of 16 European cents, up from 8 cents a year earlier. HHLA is majority owned by the city of Hamburg, but a deal late last year saw container shipping giant Mediterranean Shipping Company buy 49.9% stake in the company. Write to Dominic Chopping at dominic.chopping@wsj.com. Phillips 66 proposes new board members amid Elliott battle. Activist investor has pushed oil refiner to sell or spin off its midstream business by Lauren Thomas and Colin Eaton. Phillips 66 is nominating two new directors to its board amid an intensifying proxy fight with activist Elliott Investment Management, confirming an earlier report by the Wall Street Journal. The oil refiner disclosed four nominees, including the two new ones, in its proxy materials Wednesday morning. They will be up against Elliott's state of picks once that is finalized. Phillips 66 has a classified board, which means only a handful of seats are to be voted on at the company's annual meeting in May. On Tuesday, Elliott had filed a lawsuit against Phillips 66 and its board to require four board seats be up for election, arguing the company hadn't given enough information about how many seats would be up for a vote and was violating its rights as a shareholder. Elliott said it would pull the lawsuit if Phillips 66 would confirm that at least four director seats would be up for grabs. Phillips 66 nominees are A. Nigel Hearn, Chief Operating Officer of Harbor Energy, former leader at Chevron. Howard I. Underleader, former President and Chief Financial Officer of Dow, helped oversee the merger of Dow Chemical and DuPont, followed by the spin-out of Dow in 2019. John E. Lowe, a current board member. Robert W. Pease, a current board member who joined in 2024 in an agreement with Elliott. The oil refiner also asked shareholders to approve declassifying its board. Phillips 66 on Wednesday also advocated for keeping its current strategy. The company said that Elliott's inconsistent approach and evolving demands would introduce undue risk by prioritizing uncertain short-term gains over a disciplined long-term strategy. Elliott has been pushing for the company to sell or spin off its midstream business, which transports energy. Elliott says that business could be worth more than $40 billion. Phillips 66 has a market value of around $51 billion. Elliott, in February, disclosed a stake in Phillips 66 valued at more than $2.5 billion as it pushed the oil refiner to consider operational changes to boost its stock price. Elliott had first sought strategic improvements at the company in late 2023 after disclosing a roughly $1 billion investment. Earlier this month, Elliott nominated seven directors, including Elliott partner John Pike, in a filing late last week. Elliott said it narrowed its list down to four director candidates and three alternative candidates, with Pike in the latter group. The activist has said it could withdraw some of its nominees or make some changes since there might be not enough seats to be voted on. Phillips 66 in February said that two board members wouldn't stand for re-election. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com and Colin Eaton at colin.eaton@wsj.com. Dollar Tree to sell Family Dollar business for $1 billion. A duo of private equity firms is set to buy the discount chain, by Lauren Thomas. Dollar Tree agreed to a sale of its Family Dollar business to a consortium of private equity investors for roughly $1 billion in a bid to unlock value and continue on its turnaround plans under fresh leadership. The discount retail chain is set to be acquired by Brigade Capital Management and Marcellum Capital Management, the company announced Wednesday, confirming an earlier report from the Wall Street Journal. The journal reported last summer that Dollar Tree, in the midst of a broader turnaround, had tapped bankers to conduct a strategic review of its Family Dollar division. Though the two names sound familiar and are known for selling cut-rate merchandise, they serve different consumers. Dollar Tree stores are mostly in suburban locations and cater to middle-income households seeking party supplies, crafts, or rather knickknacks. Dollar Tree historically sold most items at $1, though recently it has boosted some prices. Family Dollar locations are more concentrated in urban areas and sell groceries, cleaning products, and other essential items at various price points. Dollar Tree outbid its rival Dollar General to acquire the Family Dollar chain in 2015 for roughly $9 billion. Dollar Tree shares are down about 10% so far this year, giving it a market value of a little less than $15 billion as of Tuesday. Since the deal, the Family Dollar business has struggled to grow and been a heavy investment lift. Dollar Tree had already started down the path of slimming it down. In early 2024, it said it would close roughly 1,000 Family Dollar locations as the business battled inflation and store theft, among other industry challenges. In December, Dollar Tree raised its full-year sales guidance in light of strong third-quarter results. The company also appointed Michael Creedon as its permanent chief executive officer and recently named a new chief financial officer to take over at the end of the month. Selling Family Dollar should allow Dollar Tree to invest for more growth and keep making bets, research analysts have said. For instance, it last year acquired leases for a group of 99 cents only stores. With the financial support of Brigade and Marcellum, Family Dollar will be well positioned for growth as a private company, Creedon said. Write to Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com. The surprising good news for mall owners, Forever 21's bankruptcy. The fast fashion retailer store closures create an opportunity for stronger tenants that can pay higher rents, by Kate King. Forever 21's bankruptcy promises to deliver the biggest raft of store closures that enclosed malls have seen in years. Mall owners are looking forward to it. The fast fashion retailer is closing all its roughly 350 U.S. stores after entering bankruptcy this month for the second time in 6 years. This time, many owners and analysts say Forever 21's demise is an opportunity to bring in stronger retailers that will pay higher rent and attract more shoppers. We're highly confident that we will release those spaces, said Steve Plenge, Chief Executive Officer of Pacific Retail Capital Partners, which has Forever 21 stores in 10 of its malls. That optimism reflects a surprisingly strong landscape for the mall industry. High-end malls are nearly fully occupied, and rents are rising. Leasing is even starting to pick up in second-tier properties as expanding retailers jockey for limited available space. Business is so good at Westfield Malls that its European owner, Unibail Rodamco Westfield, has decided to stick around the U.S. The Paris-headquartered company said in 2022 that it would move quickly to unload most of its American portfolio, which included about 24 malls. The company now plans to keep about a dozen U.S. properties, where tenant sales well outpaced inflation last year, and vacancy is at the lowest level since URW acquired Westfield in 2018. The mall industry right now, in terms of supply and demand, is in the best shape that it's been in probably 20 years, said Floris van Dijkum, managing director at the investment firm Compass Point Research and Trading, which advises institutional clients on investing in malls. Rent prices look poised to rise further, while owner MacReach said net operating income, a key industry metric that measures profitability, is at or above 2019 levels across much of its portfolio, despite rising expenses. That means rent is going up, CEO Jack Sa said in an interview. A mall industry is still far from its recent heyday of packed parking lots and overflowing food courts. Mall values remain far below the peak of 2016. Closing department stores leave large vacancies that are difficult and expensive to fill, and hundreds of low-end malls across the U.S. have either closed or are slowly dying. Malls recovered from the pandemic much more slowly than other types of retail. And if nervous consumers pull back on spending this year, recent gains could easily come undone. But the survivors' prospects are brightening, in part because no one is building enclosed malls anymore. There's no new supply. In fact, there's negative supply growth because there are still crappy malls that are closing every day, said Van Dijkum. Forever 21 first filed for bankruptcy in 2019. A group that included its two largest landlords, mall giants Simon Property Group and Brookfield Property Partners, bought the struggling retailer's operating company in February of 2020. Authentic Brands Group, which acquires distressed retail brands, bought the Forever 21 brand and still owns the intellectual property associated with it. Once the go-to spot for young shoppers looking to snag the latest styles on a budget, Forever 21 has been in decline for years, due in part to competition from discount and online retailers like Shein and Temu. The new owners closed several dozen lower-performing Forever 21 stores, but kept hundreds others open, buoying malls as the pandemic hit. The brand generated about $2 billion in revenue in fiscal year 2021 as cash-flush shoppers flocked back to stores. The company's performance and its value to its host malls has deteriorated over the past several years. Now, unless another group buys it out of bankruptcy, mall owners will likely be saddled with closing Forever 21 stores. Many welcome that outcome. It's pretty simple, Simon Property Group CEO David Simon said in an email. Demand for space is strong. We lease a better retailer at higher rents. At Bridgewater Commons in New Jersey, Plenge wants to subdivide the 5,000-square-foot Forever 21 store and lease it to two better-performing apparel tenants. He says they will generate six times the sales volume as the fast fashion retailer. At other malls, he expects tenants ranging from Dave and Buster's to TJ Maxx and local restaurateurs to fill the vacancies. There's a wide spectrum of folks to look at right now, he said. At the Westchester Mall, owned by Simon & White Plains, New York, the small Forever 21 store is surrounded by higher-end retailers from athleisure, Darling Aloe Yoga, to Louis Vuitton across the escalators. Liquidation signs are already hanging in the windows, and 25-year-old Sabrina Biagini stopped in with her mother to browse the t-shirt selection. Biagini said she often shopped at Forever 21 in high school, but now buys her clothes at more expensive brands like Anthropologie. I just kind of grew out of it, she said. Write to Kate King at kate.king@wsj.com. In today's upended office market, the Park Avenue mystique endures. The office vacancy rate is at its lowest since 2018, despite high rents. By Peter Grant. America's oldest and most venerable office districts are struggling to remain relevant during this period of changing work habits. Then there's Park Avenue. The stately boulevard, created in the late 1800s, is still one of the hottest office markets in the country. Park Avenue buildings command some of the highest office rents anywhere. These glass and steel towers are filled with white shoe law firms, real estate companies, insurers, and giant money managers, such as Blackstone. Major companies talk about leasing space in a trophy building. The stretch of Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan is the rare boulevard where companies are willing to pay up for a trophy address. Many CEOs still consider it as the premier location to call home. "It's the best place you can be on the monopoly board," said David Levinson, whose L&L Holding is the developer of 425 Park Avenue. His 47-story tower is the new home to investment powerhouse Citadel, and he recently leased the remaining floors to the State Bank of India. Just two blocks away on 3rd Avenue, desperate landlords are offering 75% discounts to the going rates on Park Avenue, but tenants seeking the Park Avenue cachet aren't interested. Financial firms are willing to pay for a Park Avenue address, in part because peers are also based there. Churchill Asset Management was outgrowing its space in 430 Park Avenue and looked at the city's other business districts. Despite finding cheaper rents, the company manager signed a new lease at the Seagram Building. Ludwig Miles van der Rohe's mid-century modern classic at 375 Park Avenue. "We're in good company," said Shay Vichness, Churchill's chief financial officer. "It makes it easier for investors when they're coming to see us that they can go up and down that stretch of Park Avenue." Park Avenue has also been a big beneficiary of the recent extension of Long Island Railroad service to Grand Central, which brings tens of thousands of daily commuters closer to Park Avenue's office towers. The city's major rezoning of a 73-block area in Midtown to encourage new development gave Park Avenue another boost. The real estate community is responding. New York last week began its public revenue process to approve construction of 350 Park Avenue, a 1.8 million square foot tower. Developer Scott Rechler and his partners announced plans for 175 Park Avenue, a $6 billion tower near Grand Central Terminal that is slated to be the tallest commercial building in the Western Hemisphere when completed in 2032. "There's not that much availability around Park Avenue," Rechler said. "That is even true during one of the worst office downturns since World War II, when remote work and a glut of supply have upended the office business. Park Avenue's vacancy rate has fallen to 8.9%, at its lowest rate since the end of 2018, according to data firm CoStar. Manhattan and U.S. office vacancy overall sits at 16.1%. Park Avenue's retailers are also cashing in. On Thursday, the line for launch at NAYA, a Middle Eastern restaurant, stretched out the door and down the block. Next door at Joe and the Juice Bar, midday orders have doubled to 200 from 1 year ago, and the staff can barely keep up. "We definitely will be hiring," said the store manager, Josephine Planchert. Park Avenue's history dates back to the expansion of commuter rail traffic to New York at the end of the 19th century. Railroad tycoon Cornelius Vanderbilt led an effort to move tracks underground to speed the passage of trains, creating a grand boulevard. Starting in the 1950s, companies from around the U.S. were uprooting their headquarters and moving to iconic Park Avenue addresses such as Lever House, Seagram Building, and the Pan Am Building, now known as the MetLife Building. More recently, Park Avenue's popularity took a hit when some big companies relocated to shiny towers in the new Hudson Yards development on the west side of Manhattan, with their elaborate fitness centers, soaring rooftop views, and plenty of natural light. But now owners of older Park Avenue buildings are splurging on expensive upgrades to remain competitive. Since the pandemic, at least three tenants have relocated from Hudson Yards to Park Avenue, according to real estate services firm Cushman and Wakefield. Developer Abby Rosen, owner of the Seagram building, opted for a $30 million upgrade after Wells Fargo left for Hudson Yards. He added an outdoor terrace and a climbing wall, boxing ring, basketball courts, yoga, and a spinning studio. Seagram's is now close to 100% leased at rents that exceed an average of $200 a square foot. Its tenants include Centerbridge Partners, Advent International, and Blue Owl Capital. In the biggest addition to Park Avenue in many years, JPM Morgan Chase plans to open this summer its new 60-story headquarters. The $3 billion tower will house up to 10,000 workers and offer 2.5 times more ground-level outdoor space than J.P. Morgan's old 1950s-era headquarters at the site. The tower will include a food hall with 19 restaurants, fitness and wellness centers, spaces for prayer and meditation, and two outdoor gardens. New York zoning change enabled J.P. Morgan Chase to add 1 million square feet to make it a 2.5 million square foot building. It's a great example of urban renewal, said David Arena, the bank's head of global corporate real estate. Write to Peter Grant at peter.grant@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Ad Forecaster reduces growth prediction for 2025, citing poor economic visibility, low consumer confidence. Magna now expects U.S. ad sales to increase 4.3% this year, down from its earlier forecast of 4.9%, by Megan Graham. A major ad industry forecaster has downgraded its U.S. growth projection for 2025 because of a lack of economic visibility and a decline in consumer confidence that it said would be a drag on marketing and advertising budgets in the short term. Magna, a research unit that is part of Interpublic Group's IPG Media Brands, said Wednesday that it expects U.S. ad sales to reach $397 billion this year, an increase of 4.3% from 2024, when factoring in cyclical events such as last year's election season. The company in December released a forecast predicting growth of 4.9% in 2025. The updated forecast, like the earlier one, anticipates a slowdown from U.S. advertising sales in 2024, which reached $380 billion and marked at 12.4% increase from the previous year, boosted by political campaigns and spending around the Olympics. Excluding cyclical events, Magna says U.S. ad spending rose 9.9% last year. It now forecasts that U.S. ad revenue will grow 6.7% in 2025, trimming its previous estimate that non-cyclical ad revenue would rise 7.3%. Confidence plays a crucial role in marketing and advertising investment decisions, Vincent Lettang, Executive Vice President of Global Market Intelligence at Magna, said in the report. The current, hopefully temporary, dip in confidence has already dampened the dynamics of the ad market, prompting us to revise our growth forecasts for 2025. Magna also said that the lack of visibility and risk of trade war could cause marketing ad budgets to see freezes or cuts in industries that are vulnerable to global trade, supply chain disruptions, and consumer confidence issues. Those could include quick service restaurants and the consumer packaged goods, food, drinks, personal care, and automotive sectors, which are exposed to international supply chains and global prices. Still, Magna said that some factors will help the advertising business this year. Despite the challenges posed by economic uncertainty, organic growth factors such as media innovation, AI, retail media, and ad-supported streaming will continue to enhance the effectiveness and efficiency of advertising formats, encouraging advertisers to maintain or expand their budgets, the report said. Write to Megan Graham at megan.graham at wsj.com. 23andMe went from a $6 billion giant to bankruptcy. Its former CEO won't walk away. Annie Wojcik aims to buy the assets of her failed DNA testing company after her prior bids were rejected. By Rolf Winkler. Annie Wojcik isn't ready to let go. The company set she co-founded, 23andMe, has burned through more than $1 billion and laid off more than half of its staff. A board of directors Wojcik stalked with her friends resigned en masse in September because they couldn't get on board with her strategy for the maker of at-home DNA tests. On Sunday night, the company filed for bankruptcy protection, its survival uncertain. Wojcik immediately vowed to buy it back. Can-do optimism helped Wojcik bring the DNA test to millions. It's also led her to pursue expensive and ultimately failed strategies to use 23andMe's trove of medical data to develop drugs and provide health care. The odds are no longer tilted in her favor. In bankruptcy court, her super-voting shares, which previously enabled her to block other bidders, have been wiped out, and her earlier bids for the company, which she once joked would be bigger than Google, were rejected by two boards of directors. Wojcik said in a statement that it is difficult to innovate in healthcare. 23andMe pioneered something radically different. To put the individual in direct control of important information about themselves, empowering them to think about their genetic identity and personalize preventative care in a whole new way. Wojcik grew up at the center of Silicon Valley, the daughter of the one-time chair of Stanford University's physics department. She played ice hockey at Yale and worked at finance firms after college, analyzing healthcare companies. Her sister, Susan Wojcik, rented her Palo Alto garage to a pair of engineers, starting a company called Google. Wojcik met Google co-founder Sergey Brin, who introduced her to Linda Avey, the founder of a yet-to-be-named genetics startup. Wojcik became a co-founder of what became 23andMe. 23andMe initially struggled to excite people about genetic testing, which cost $399 in 2008. To generate buzz, they staged spit parties at New York's Fashion Week and the World Economic Forum in Davos, where celebrities spit into 23andMe tubes to provide their DNA sample. The price came down, but in 2013, the Food and Drug Administration told 23andMe to stop marketing its health test after it said the company failed to provide data and get clearance for it. Wojcik, by now running the company solo, pressed on. Her friend and former FDA commissioner, David Kessler, recalled in an interview telling her to take the agency's warning seriously, and she did, ultimately securing clearance for a consumer genetic test. With FDA support and a $99 price tag, the test had mass market appeal as stories filtered out about people discovering lost siblings or parents, 23andMe went viral. From the beginning, the company faced a challenge that never went away. People only need to take and pay for one DNA test. So Wojcicki looked for new ways to profit from its repository of genetic data. She raised more cash and plowed it into the new drug discovery business, aiming to use 23andMe's data to make new medicines. It can take years and hundreds of millions of dollars to get a new drug to market, which made that plan risky. She walked the Met Gala red carpet with then-boyfriend and baseball star Alex Rodriguez, carrying a clutch decorated with DNA test chips, and regularly attended Vanity Fair's Oscars party with her sister. Wojcicki leased a new Sunnyvale office building with enough space to double staff. There was a gym and free lunch. A staffer posted Richard Simmons placards in the stairwells when Wojcicki, a health nut who rode her bike to work many days, said she wanted a fun way to discourage elevator riding. The company went public in 2021 and was briefly valued just above $6 billion. It had secured even more capital, but was still struggling to generate recurring revenue. Wojcicki bought struggling telehealth company Lemonade Health for $400 million, hoping it could use genetic reports to provide better patient care. The plan didn't work, and Lemonade's value halved. In 2020, Wojcicki launched 23andMe, joining the stampede of companies offering subscription content offerings. 23andMe had23andMe had told investors that millions of customers would sign up. Only a few hundred thousand did. With cash dwindling, the company staged multiple rounds of layoffs in 2023. And by April 2024, its stock languishing below a dollar, Wojcicki said she would take the companies private. With 49% voting control, she said she would block any other bidder. At August 2023, directors rejected her first bid for the company, writing her a letter saying they were disappointed. At the time, Wojcicki was tending to her sister Susan, who was in the hospital with terminal cancer and who had lost her son, Wojcicki's nephew, 6 months earlier. Susan Wojcicki died a week later. The board waited a month and then resigned as a group, saying they disagreed with Wojcicki over the company's strategic direction. After the resignation of the first board, Wojcicki appointed a new one in October, paying three new directors $800,000 up front, 2 weeks before the 23andMe laid off 40% of its staff. 5 months later, they rejected her bid of 0.41 cents a share. Shares fell 60% to 73 cents on Monday, the day after the bankruptcy filing. The Sunnyvale office Wojcicki designed sits mostly empty. Its lease is likely to be discharged in bankruptcy. Write to Wolf Winkler at wolf.winkler@wsj.com. Greenlanders are angry and confused over unwanted U.S. visit. Greenland says coming visit is active aggression as Trump doubles down on pressuring self-governing Danish territory. By Soon Engel Rasmussen, Natalie Andrews, and Vera Bergengruen. A planned visit to Greenland this week will be led by Second Lady Usha Vance, was organized and presented as a feel-good event to celebrate Greenlandic culture. Instead, it's stirring anger and anxiety and testing already strained relations between the U.S. and European allies. And that was before Vice President J.T. Vance announced that he would be joining his wife on the trip. The U.S. has now shifted The visits focus to national security, even as both Danish and Greenlandic officials have insisted they see the uninvited trip as a provocation. Instead of taking in a dog sled race as originally scheduled, the Vances will be visiting American soldiers at the U.S. military base, far from any large settlement of civilian Greenlanders, White House officials said Tuesday. Greenland has denounced the visit by the delegation, which the White House said Sunday would include National Security Advisor Michael Waltz and Secretary of Energy Chris Wright, as a highly aggressive move. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said on Tuesday, dialed up the rhetoric against Washington, saying that the scheduled visit puts completely unacceptable pressure on Greenland, Greenlandic politicians, and the Greenlandic population, as well as on Denmark. President Trump is serious, she told Danish television. He wants Greenland. Vance said Tuesday that he chose to join his wife Friday because of the pushback from the Danish government. I decided I didn't want her to have all that fun by herself, and so I'm going to join her, Vance said, in a video posted Tuesday by X. The vice president went on to reframe the trip as a really important matter for the U.S. national security. The U.S. trip adds to confusion in Greenland and Denmark about what the Trump administration actually wants with the self-governing territory of Denmark. Beyond stating that Greenland is important to U.S. national security and poorly protected by Denmark, and indicating that he covets its critical minerals, the only concrete wish Trump has expressed about Greenland is for the U.S. to own it. That stated desire has unsettled Greenlanders. Many watched Trump's speech to Congress this month when he said about their homeland, one way or the other, we're going to get it, followed by laughter from some in the audience. Late on Sunday, residents of Nuuk, Greenland's capital, watched as two U.S. Hercules military transport planes touched down at the airport, carrying security personnel and bulletproof vehicles in an apparent preparation for the visit. Greenlandic politicians say the trip amounts to meddling in their domestic affairs as they negotiate the formation of a new government after an election this month. The winner was a party that firmly rejects U.S. advances and advocates slowing down the island's push for independence. It's disrespectful to do this without an official invitation, while Greenland is in the process of forming a government, said Aja Kremnitz, one of the two Greenlandic members of the Danish parliament. Greenland decides its own future, and we will reach out to the U.S. of our own accord if we want closer cooperation. Trump on Monday rejected the notion that the coming visit was provocation. Despite the lack of official invitation, he claimed that the delegation has been invited by the people of Greenland. Jorgen Boesen, a 50-year-old bricklayer, who in recent months has become known as Greenland's most outspoken Trump supporter, said earlier this week that he helped plan the visit, but on Tuesday declined to comment. In January, Boesen visited Washington for Trump's inauguration, along with a new prominent member of Greenland's most fervently pro-independent party, Niall Oraj. Trump and Denmark's Frederiksen have a history of feuding. In 2019, Frederiksen called Trump's idea of buying Greenland absurd, a comment Trump slammed as nasty. Until Tuesday, Frederiksen had kept a largely diplomatic tone. This time around, while touring Europe to drum up support for diplomatic defense of Greenland, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has suggested increasing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's troop presence in Greenland to counter Trump's claims that the island isn't protected. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot has said it is out of the question that the European Union would let another country attack its borders. While Trump raised the idea of buying Greenland in his first term, his claims in his second term that he wants to acquire it is in keeping with his apparent notions of U.S. expansion. He has pushed for America to retake control of the Panama Canal and has called Canada the 51st state. He has said acquiring Greenland is an absolute necessity and refused to rule out using military force to take over the island of 57,000 people. He has also threatened a very, very high tariffs if Denmark refused to cooperate. I think Greenland's going to be something that maybe is in our future, Trump said in a cabinet meeting on Monday. I think it's important. It's important from the standpoint of international security. Greenland is a prized asset for its strategic location and deposits of critical minerals, and it has already for decades welcomed a significant U.S. presence. It holds a commanding position in the Arctic as a buffer between North America and Russia. Trump and J.D. Vance said Denmark was unable to protect the island, three times the size of Texas. The territory has no army and relies on an aging fleet of seven Danish ships for protection. However, expecting Copenhagen to exert full armed control over a territory 50 times the size of Denmark proper is unrealistic, especially amid growing military demands in Ukraine and the Baltic Sea. In January, Denmark announced a $1.9 billion package to upgrade Greenland's defense, which seemingly failed to mollify Trump. The U.S. has the freedom to strengthen up its own military presence in Greenland if it wishes to. Under the 1951 defense agreement with Copenhagen, the U.S. can deploy troops and maintain military bases on the island. During the Cold War, it at times kept up to 17 military installations in Greenland, including radars and early warning systems. Today, the U.S. holds only a Pitlochry space base, formerly known as the Thule Airbase, home to a range of missile warning sensors and space surveillance and control sensors. U.S. officials have also expressed interest in Greenland's underground wealth. Yet large-scale exploitation of its minerals remains a distant prospect, not because of resistance from Greenland's government, but due to poor infrastructure, a harsh climate, ice that covers 80% of the island, and a reluctance from investors to fund mining operations there. The recent Greenlandic reactions mark a stark departure from the mood only a few months ago. While polling shows that an overwhelming majority of Greenlanders don't want to be American, there is widespread desire in the island for more autonomy to build commercial and political ties with other nations independent of Copenhagen's policies. In October, United Airlines announced it would begin direct flights this summer from New York to a newly built airport in Nuuk, prompting hopes in Greenland of more American trade and tourism. Now Trump has turned some of those hopes into concerns, said Ulrich Pramgaard, senior researcher with the Danish Institute for International Studies. There was an opening, but he has closed it now, Gaard said of Trump. My impression is that Greenlanders no longer trust his intentions and are starting to get a little scared. Greenland has, for the past 40 years, move towards self-determination, he added. All the influence over its foreign policy and minerals, which it has wrangled from Copenhagen, is not something they want to just hand over to Washington. Natalie Andrews at natalie.andrews@wsj.com and Vera Bergrugren at vera.bergrugren@wsj.com. And now for some opinion articles. Tariffs and the slowing economy. Tariff uncertainty and business caution are hitting first quarter growth. By the editorial board. President Trump says tariffs will usher in a new era of American prosperity, but the U.S. economy isn't sharing the anticipatory enthusiasm. A variety of indicators in recent weeks show a slowdown in first quarter growth, which suggests this is an especially bad time to add new taxes and economic uncertainty. Initial claims for unemployment benefits jumped 22,000 last week, while consumer spending slowed sharply in January. The housing market remains in mediocre shape, A surge of imports in January as businesses try to get ahead of tariffs suggests how companies are trying to hedge against broader taxes. All of this has moved the Atlanta Federal Reserve's GDP and now growth estimate for the first quarter to -1.5%. That scorecard is volatile and changes as new real-time data arrive, but Wall Street forecasters have also been reducing their growth estimates. This isn't cause for panic, but it is for tariff caution. Mr. Trump is promising to impose his 25% levies on Mexico and Canada this week, which will send auto and other North American supply chains into chaos. China gets hit with another 10% broader tax, with European cars up next, followed by reciprocal tariffs on most of the world. A tariff is a tax, and taxes impose costs that reduce economic activity. They also add uncertainty about where and how business should invest, as CEOs try to figure out where the tariffs will strike, on which goods, and for how long. Will there be exceptions? If growth continues to slow, Mr. Trump can't say he wasn't warned. Europe arms for the tariff war. The U.S. also has much to lose in a dumb and dumber trade brawl. By the editorial board, trade wars are easy to win, President Trump once opined. Until that is, the other side starts fighting back. That's the message from a thinly veiled European threat to impose steep retaliation on the U.S. if Mr. Trump slaps tariff on Europe. Some European governments, notably France, want to invoke a relatively new anti-coercion instrument against America if Mr. Trump opens a trade war with the European Union. This legal tool allows the European Union to impose trade sanctions on foreign countries that try to bully Europeans into changing their economic policies. The specific bullying the Europeans have in mind concerns Mr. Trump's complaints about Europe's value-added taxes, VATs, on final consumption. Mr. Trump believes these taxes are protectionist because European companies don't pay them on exports, but some imported goods are taxed. Mr. Trump is threatening to impose reciprocal tariffs on European countries that charge VATs. But as these VATs end up hitting U.S. exporters with the same tax rate they do domestic European producers, there's less and more that meets the eye to the European retaliation threat. The anti-coercion policy is a political gimmick that doesn't create any new trade enforcement policies for the EU or its member countries. But by the same token, the EU or its member countries could impose many of the same penalties already available under EU law, even without formally invoking the anti-coercion provision. These penalties start with the retaliatory tariffs the EU is likely to impose in April on American motorcycles, beef, and whiskey in response to the Trump steel and aluminum tariffs. Stepping up a notch, the EU and its member countries could ban specific imports from the U.S. or block American companies from bidding for public procurement contracts. The nuclear option is the ability to stop enforcing intellectual property protections for American companies in Europe, such as the trademarks for large U.S. companies. This is on top of all the other indignities to which Brussels mandarins can subject American companies virtually at will. U.S. companies wishing to merge might find their deals tied up for years by European antitrust regulators. Brussels already files corporate tax litigation against American companies for sport and expect any last vestiges of tax restraint to fade amid a trade war. The danger is that a trade war unleashes Europe's worst instincts. It's not an accident that France seems to be the ringleader agitating for tougher retaliation, especially measures such as the intellectual property provisions that would put brute force behind Paris's long-standing resentment over U.S. tech companies. None of this would be smart for Europe's economy. Think of it as the dumb and dumber trade war. Still, if Mr. Trump is going to sabotage America with protectionism, He can't be surprised if other governments are willing to hurt themselves to retaliate. And the truth is, they can do a lot of damage to the U.S. in the process. The marijuana Laffer curve. The California left demands tax rate relief for the high and flighty. By the editorial board. What does it take to persuade a progressive to cut tax rates? Answer. Make sure the tax cut applies to the cannabis industry. We kid you not, as Democrats in Sacramento are discovering that high tax rates on hooch can harm the legal version of their favorite recreational drug, Art Laffer must be on a high. This delightful discovery of the marijuana Laffer curve comes from the assemblyman Mitt Haney of San Francisco, where else, as he unveiled legislation to prevent a looming tax increase on legal cannabis in California. If you keep on taxing and taxing a set of businesses that are already competing with folks who are paying no taxes, eventually those folks are going to go out of business direct entirely, and you're not going to get anything, Mr. Haney said this week. Progressives sold voters in 2016 on legalizing marijuana for recreational use. They used the usual arguments that legal pot would reduce drug trafficking and raise tax revenue. But the state imposed taxes that are so high and regulations so burdensome that the illegal marijuana growers and sellers are crowding out the folks who follow the rules. Marijuana is subject to a 7.75% state sales tax, 15% state excise tax, and various local taxes, which have been increasing as cities try to plug budget holes. The 15% excise tax is set to raise to 19% in July, which has pot business begging Sacramento for tax relief. Enter Mr. Haney, a Bernie Sanders acolyte who is proposing to suspend the tax increase to save what he calls California's dying cannabis industry. We can either support this legal industry, these small businesses, to be able to build the thriving cannabis industry that we now know California can grow, or we can tax or overregulate this industry to death. He frets that California is being outpaced in cannabis sales by states like Michigan, which has demonstrated steady growth due to lower taxes and fewer barriers to access the legal industry for both businesses and consumers. The result, he says, is plummeting sales and tax revenue. What's sad about this Laffer curb epiphany is that Mr. Haney thinks it only applies to pot. He and his Sacramento friends keep piling taxes and regulation on every other business and industry, driving many out of state. And that's all the time we have for today's reading. That brings us to the end of this edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.